trauma, and I'm going to be talking about medical mistrust among family members of adults with intellectual disabilities on this project by myself and Dr. Joanne Wilkinson. We have no disclosures. We were funded by a National Cancer Institute Career Development Award to Joanne. And so I'll be talking about the health needs and a little bit of context about people with intellectual disabilities, the project that we worked on that we ended up exploring mistrust. It wasn't really intended that way, which I'll talk about in a minute. It came up as a qualitative finding that we couldn't ignore in a different project. And then I'll talk about our findings related to mistrust and family caregivers. So just give you a little bit of a background in intellectual disability. This used to be called mental retardation, which is a word we're really trying to get away from, and used to be defined in terms of IQ. We're really moving, you know, and as we should be, I think, to a more functional definition of intellectual disability, looking at limitations and challenges in everyday life. And today, most people with intellectual disabilities live and receive care in the community, which is a great thing, although we still have a ways to go towards full community participation. Which brings me to the history of intellectual disability and kind of how we've handled intellectual disability in this country. And I wanted to spend a few minutes on this because when we talk about mistrust, frankly, I think this is a population that has very good reason to mistrust the medical system. Starting in about the 1850s, we really medicalized intellectual disability, so we saw it as a medical problem versus one of many attributes that makes a person who they are. And one of the changes that medicalization led to was institutionalization, where people were housed, you know, for their entire lives, really overcrowded, inhumane, horrible treatment. And there's some photos of the conditions. And this is a photo of Willowbrook, which was the site of one of the more horrific research and medical abuses against people with intellectual disabilities, where children in an institution, Willowbrook Institution on Staten Island, were given hepatitis to study the natural history of the disease. Hepatitis is not, you know, a good thing. They learned that from that study. And this was just one of many research abuses against this population. And research was often very much tied to medical abuses. So there's this really strong history of mistrust. I'm going to have to say, too, I'm a family caregiver for a woman in her, my aunt, who's in her 50s, who has an intellectual disability, and when she was born, my grandmother was essentially told to leave her in an institution and forget about it, and, you know, it's been over 50 years. I wasn't alive at that point, but it's a really living memory in my family. It's something we think about all the time when we think about my aunt and healthcare. So things have gotten a lot better. We've really moved the deinstitutionalization movement, which began in the 60s and 70s, we've really moved to community living. This photo here on the side is Monica and David, which is a documentary. If you haven't seen it, you should, about a young couple who I believe both have Down syndrome, and really moving towards much more active participation in all aspects of community life. This is me and my aunt, and I love this photo because it was taken in her neighborhood. We're coming back from a neighborhood event, and I just love that you can really see the community context that she lives in now. We like to take selfies when we hang out. But I think, you know, despite all the advances, we still do have a long way to go. There's a lot of disparities in terms of access to health care, cancer screening, health education, research participation, high rates of unemployment and underemployment among people who are able to work, much higher rates of social isolation. People are more likely to report having little to no friends, despite wanting to participate in the community, and very low levels of funding for practical and programmatic support, which means that whether or not the person with the intellectual disability resides with their family, that family members end up providing a lot of care. And so our work focuses primarily on primary care and women's health care for women with intellectual disabilities. Joanne has a K award that just ended related to breast cancer screening and mammography use to address the big disparities in breast cancer mortality rates in this population. And so a lot of the work we've done around mammography has looked at women with intellectual disabilities and cancer screening in different contexts. So how women themselves perceive mammography, how their direct support workers perceive mammography, and their physicians. And we've developed a lot of media-based interventions to promote breast cancer screening. And we think it's really important to look at the context that women are accessing cancer screening or not. So we've looked at family life and support workers, partly because women with intellectual disabilities have varying degrees of dependency on the people around them. And also we just believe that the more holistic and contextualized an intervention is, the more it makes sense in the real world. And so we were in this study. We started out doing a qualitative study of family members of women with intellectual disabilities looking at their perceptions of breast cancer screening. We know that women who live with their families have the lowest rates of any subpopulation based on residence of women with ID. They have the lowest rates of breast cancer screening. So we wanted to look at families, and we figured we'd find similar barriers as we did with direct support workers and women themselves, very practical things like, I don't know what to do when I get to the mammogram facility, sort of lack of information. And instead, our study really focused on mistrust. And so I just want to point out that with family members, I think as Willie and Sue have talked about, I won't spend much time on this, we know that caregiving impacts health of the caregiver. And we think that it also, health beliefs of the caregiver may impact the health of the person with disabilities. This hasn't been studied as much, so that was another reason that we wanted to do this qualitative study of family members. And what came up in these interviews, usually within, you know, the first 3 minutes of introducing myself at the start of the interview, was mistrust. And it wasn't even included on our original interview guide, but participants, because we were using semi-structured interviews, participants were able to raise themes of importance to them. And so, yeah, I think there was one interview where mistrust came up about 15 minutes into the interview, but usually it was within the first few minutes. And so we did a qualitative analysis using content analysis and some grounded coded theory and came up with these different kind of codes or themes related to mistrust, including individual experiences like the one my family sort of lives with about my aunt, my grandmother being told to institutionalize my aunt and move on. So individual experiences that led to kind of general or overall mistrust. Difficulties or issues that came up during that transition from pediatric care to adult-focused primary care, which Sue talked about. And kind of this idea that family caregivers knew their loved one better than anyone else and therefore were better qualified to address health concerns than medical professionals. And then the impacts of prior experiences on their interpretation of physician recommendations was a big theme too. So I want to point out that I keep using the word child, but I want to be very conscious that I'm talking about adult children. We completed 17 interviews in this study, and all but three were with mothers. But it's important to acknowledge that I mean adults in their 40s and 50s. And so this first theme, early experiences creating mistrust. Sometimes it was sort of less of a direct insult or injury than the sense that this mother wasn't being taken seriously by medical professionals. So when T was born, in her very, very first year of life, I did start to have some concerns about meeting developmental milestones. And when I first brought this to the attention of her pediatrician, that pediatrician dismissed me as a nervous first-time mom. And then there were more disability-related instances of bad early experiences. So with people who sort of just dismissed her because of what they saw as an intellectual incapacity to do certain things or understand certain things, or they just they saw her Down syndrome before they saw a person who might have a medical issue. So we worked really hard to find people who are more empathetic than that and people who'd be kind with her. So, and she's very intuitive too. If she were to see someone, she'd know right away, you know, I'm not comfortable here. And this came up a lot in our interviews too, that the person, the loved one with a disability was perceived as just a disability rather than a whole person. And then this was a heartbreaking interview. After we got the correct diagnosis, she needed open heart surgery ASAP. We had to go to the cardiologist. And she said to us, in front of the other doctors, you know, we had to go in front of a sort of panel to justify this. And she said, well, heart surgery won't cure her Down syndrome. And this was actually the mother of a young woman in her 20s. We work with an advisory board of self-advocates with intellectual disabilities, including two women in their early 20s whose mothers have shared similar type experiences with me. So that was particularly striking to me, that this really wasn't that long ago at all. And we don't do work with parents of younger children with intellectual disabilities, but I've sort of heard empirically from friends that this kind of thing still is said. And so as you can imagine, being told that, you know, it might be ethical to withhold life-saving surgery from one's child because she has Down syndrome can create a lot of mistrust. And then after those early experiences, the transition to adult care was really uncomfortable for a lot of people. And we know that that transitional period from pediatric to adult primary care is sort of a dangerous time for folks. We see a lot more emergency department admissions and a lot fewer primary care experiences. So we had a pediatrician that we were comfortable with for 20 years. And as the girls were getting older and reaching a point that we needed to transition to adult care, and as you know, it's very difficult to find a PCP, a primary care provider, for neurotypical people. That's very much more complicated for individuals with disability. And once we settled down and she was about 3, we came up with a really, really good pediatrician who we had until just a few years ago. And then she transferred over to my PCP, which makes life easier. You know, I'm not wild about her, but she's good enough. And then this was a really interesting theme to us. So this question of why trust clinicians when the family provides so much day-to-day care for this individual and knows her best. So S-Swim, she does Special Olympic swimming. And one of her traits is that she'll sometimes cover her ears if there's a loud noise or a baby crying. So there was a time when there was a difference in how she was doing that, and I was concerned. I called her PCP and brought her in, and she had swimmer's ears. S can't say, my ears hurt, or this is bothering me. It's just we know her so well that when we see something different, we watch closely. And I think we have all gotten to know when M's in pain. She doesn't have much vision, but her hearing is really strong. And even with her limited vision, she's able to identify us. She gives us different looks, so the parent is so adept at reading the child that, you know, why bring her into a facility that has caused her harm in the past? And this is just a really evocative quote for me related to this theme. It was a horrible experience, but it was her first experience of, wow, we can't always trust the medical professionals, first of all, and sometimes we're going to have to fight for what our daughter needs and deserves. And people aren't necessarily going to always agree with that or offer that, which was a completely foreign concept. But so that was a terrible experience, but we were able to get her what we needed, what she needed, and so she started to thrive. So really learning to trust in oneself and one's perceptions more than medical professionals. But a really interesting thing, so potential limitation of this study was everyone included was middle to upper middle class, so had a lot of access in general. And also the study was done in Massachusetts, where I think it's starting to change with the ACA, but we have more access in general than many parts of the country. So family members had quite a bit of access for themselves and really trusted the medical system, again, for themselves. So they themselves had regular mammograms, though their loved one in her 50s or 60s had had 0 or 1 mammogram, so it was a really interesting idea that we started calling mistrust by proxy or mistrust on behalf of the loved one with ID. And, you know, it really made a lot of intuitive sense to us that if medical professionals haven't always had the child's best interest at heart and work in a system, a medical system that doesn't always see people with disabilities as people, it made a lot of sense that though relatives trusted the medical system for their own care, they were less trusting on behalf of their family member. So we came up with this quantitative instrument, the Family Medical Mistrust Instrument, or FAMI. It was based on the Mistrust in Physician Scale, which is a really well-studied, validated instrument. And we changed the questions a little bit to reflect the experience of family members. And we also administered it to people with intellectual disabilities. And then we added 2 additional questions to the scale, the FAMI, for relatives about whether or not their relative is likely to encounter discrimination in healthcare environments. And for people with intellectual disabilities, we translated that as I'm treated the same as other people in healthcare settings. And then we added a question about family involvement. And so we're currently working on refining this instrument, doing pre- and post-testing and expert panel. And one potential issue that's come up a lot that we're planning to address in the 2.0 version of the FAMI after we finish adapting it is this idea that people many times reported they did have an individual physician, usually a pediatrician, that they loved but didn't trust the healthcare system as a whole. And for something like cancer screening that involved leaving their friendly primary care provider and going to a different facility, like a mammogram facility, and encountering other unknown healthcare professionals, that was a whole different ballgame. And we think that this is really something that we need a lot more research about how to address within the healthcare system as a whole, health services research. So family members of adults with intellectual disabilities mistrusted the healthcare system, both in terms of technical aspects of her care and then also to see her as a person, not just a walking disability. And family members' mistrust was rooted in historical negative experiences, both personal experiences and sort of systems factors that influence the entire kind of trickle down and mistrust that's kind of encoded in communities and cultural systems. And I think it's important, as clinicians to know that families see us as part of a cultural system that doesn't always value their loved one. And this mistrust isn't intensified during the transition from pediatric to adult care. And families felt that they knew their child better than medical professionals did and would notice health issues before clinicians did. Including this really, it wasn't just a perception, this really had happened. So I think on a clinician level, it's really important to incorporate family perspectives to individualize care and get input from both the family member and the individual. Because this mistrust impacts people's access to care. We're also working on pilot testing an intervention we made. This is a media-based intervention that I'm actually talking about in a different session, so I won't say too much. But one of the things we did with this intervention was model supportive, positive interactions with the medical system with using, this is Jillian Berube, who's one of our collaborators with intellectual disabilities who acted in the movie, and two of my coworkers who are, I think, sorry they ran into me in the hall that morning because I pulled them into filmmaking. This is my pit bull looking super vicious. She's afraid of the snow. Thank you. Okay. So the first few items on the mistrust in physician or trust in physician scale looked at interpersonal relationships. So the original item was things like my doctor really cares about me as a person, my doctor is considerate of my needs and puts them first. I trust my doctor so much that I follow his or her advice. And then for the family members, we adapted it to say things like the doctor my relative sees the most cares about him or her as a person, is considerate of my relative's needs, and I trust the doctor my relative sees, and I try to help my relative follow this doctor's advice. And then for individuals with intellectual disabilities, we adapted it to say, the doctor I see the most really cares about me as a person. The doctor that I see the most puts me first. And so essentially for the individuals with intellectual disabilities, we created a plain language summary of an instrument that's currently in use. And for the family members, we changed the wording from the original instrument to say my relative versus me. The next items were about the doctor's clinical judgment. So things like if the doctor tells me that something is so, then it must be true. I sometimes distrust my doctor's opinion and would like a second one. I trust my doctor's judgment about my medical care. And for relatives, it was just changed to reflect their my relative versus the doctor I see. And then the next items on the scale are about thoroughness or completeness of care. So I feel my doctor does not do everything that he or she should. So this is more a systems level question about whether the doctor sends one on for referrals and things like that. And the next one, kind of related to systems level, is I trust my doctor to put my medical needs above all other considerations. And again, for relatives, they were just reworded. And for individuals with intellectual disabilities, we have a plain language summary. And then the last three for the original questions were, my doctor is well qualified to manage, diagnose, treat, or make an appropriate referral, medical problems like mine. For relatives, we changed it a little bit because we didn't want to suggest that we viewed intellectual disability as a medical condition. We wanted to focus on other medical conditions a relative might have, like diabetes, asthma, things unrelated to disability, that we know there's a lot of disparities in treatment for. So we said, I feel that the doctor that my relative sees the most knows enough about her condition to treat her effectively. Or condition or disability, and then, which is something I think we are changing the wording of a little bit more on the second version. And for adults with intellectual disability, it was, my doctor knows enough about me and my health to take care of me well. The last two items were about personal trust and confidentiality. So I trust my doctor to tell me if a mistake was made about my treatment. And I sometimes worry that my doctor may not keep information we discuss totally private. Yeah, sorry I didn't go into more detail with it.